Welcome to the Hacktivist Podcast, conversations that matter.
And welcome to another episode of the Hacktivist Podcast. In the spirit of what we've been doing so far, I have with me here today
Peter Dankwa.
As usual, my name is Michael. So let's just dive right in. Peter.
Yes.
Did you grow up in Ghana?
Yes, all my life. First at La Paz. That was during my primary school days. Then from SHS to university, Spintex.
Okay. How was growing up in La Paz like? I know it has evolved over the years. It used to be not so vibrant as it is now.
Yes. La Paz was full of kids who love to play outside, and I lived in a typical compound house, so I got exposure to different, if I should use the word tribes, yes, and getting to hear different languages. And it's amazing that I do not speak the Ghana language, though I've been here all my life. And as for my hometown language, I also don't know how to speak it, so it's basically English. And I remember my parents being angry at me that when they are speaking Cree with me, I'm speaking English, because that was how we were trained. So La Paz was a place where I learned, should I say, the ghetto life. But my parents were more of the diplomatic type, so it was a merge of diplomacy and trying to be, in quote, hardcore, because most of the people there were tough guys. But my family, because they were Christian and my dad had a reputable job, sort of that, if I should say, a lighthouse by the shore or something. So everybody knew that this family is different, because my parents were very devout Christians and they had very good jobs. So it was quite of that experience.
Do you have siblings also that you interacted with?
Yes, I have two younger sisters.
Okay.
Yeah.
So formative years, how would you characterize those years as, from say 8-0 to 5, living in La Paz, living in a compound house? What do you think informed most of your life during that time?
I noticed that during that period, I loved to learn basically anything. My very first aspiration was to be a pilot, and it had always been in my mind. So anything that comes to studies, I loved it. It was easy for me to connect with books. So it wasn't surprising that I was the best student in my school. And also, I would say because of how my parents were, I was more of someone who respected opinion, or let's say silence, because in being taught to be a good person always, you shouldn't say something that offends the other person. So as I said, always being diplomatic, try not to make someone uncomfortable with what I say. So always it was more of the jovial type. I was a sanguine, because I tried to make everybody laugh anywhere I go. Everybody knew that so far as I come there, it's going to be fun and all jokes. So from 0 to 5, I would say I was basically learning more about myself, because I realized there were so many things I was being exposed to. There was one guy in our compound house who knew how to work with crafts. He could pick this milk tin and create cars, and I was surprised because I didn't have any knowledge of it, but how he was able to do that. So I realized that there's a lot of things to learn, and there were guys who were good at football and all that. So I was basically trying to find where I would fit, and where I would fit was with the books, and it always showed. So it was more of learning. So that's how my formative years were.
And life in primary school, which primary school was that?
That was Cosmos Basic School at La Paz.
Okay, okay. And life in primary school, GHS, how was that like? Were there any standout moments during that time?
Yes, and amazingly, though I'm a sanguine, I noticed that right in primary school, I had a problem of socializing because I wasn't taught how to socialize. So I remember once my class one teacher, Miss Hetty, used to call me Mr. Stiff. Mm. And that was because she always said that, for example, if it's break time and they ring the bell and you're supposed to go out, I get up and I walk in a straight line to the canteen. I don't move my head left or right. All that I'm doing is I'm moving straight. If I'm asked a question, I just get up, answer the question, and sit back down. And in retrospect, I realized that I always had this anxiety as to whether I'm properly representing myself to the other person. So I did. It became so awkward that I became stiff. So in trying to relate to other people, mm-hmm. it wasn't so clear for me in that way. And one thing that stands out is that because I love learning, and in primary school there's always competition, there was these two guys who, when we do the ranking according to examination scores, they were always first. They were always first. I was usually in the top 10. So I realized, I told myself that I have to get them because I knew I was good. But always, they were always first, second, first, second, first, second, first, second. But I got to a point, I became second. And the reason was because the topmost guy had left the school. So it pushed me up by default. But I still kept pushing myself, and gradually I became the best. And it was a surprise to me because the space in which I had been able to covered that territory was quite surprising, looking at the fact that there were people already there who from day one were known as the best students. And if you are going to do any average or accumulation of that, you realize that they are the ones supposed to probably be at the top. But it was amazing how within a short space, probably about 2 or 3 years before I completed GHS, was when I had that period. And it came from an inspiration from our pre-tech teacher, who, and this might sound a little bit chauvinistic, and in fact it was chauvinistic looking back, because he said, why do you allow the ladies to beat you? Because it was a lady who was always stopping, and I was like, I will never let any woman beat you. And I was so angry. I remember every time I saw that lady in my head, I was saying, I'll show you that I really know what I'm about. So because of that, I pushed myself, and I got to become the best. So primary was more of learning and trying to socialize. So that's why the fact that it was difficult for me to represent myself, because I didn't know what the other person thought of me and other things. I still was sanguine anyway. Anywhere I go, I tried to crack jokes and all that. I was the type of guy in class, when the teacher is teaching, we'll be making fun. Maybe you draw some things, or communicating with other people in the class, making fun and all that. So primary was basically fun for me, but there was this awkwardness when it came to me being able to communicate with other people.
Mm. And did you feel the pressure of being the first one?
Honestly, I didn't. I was more carefree, and I remember once, I think it was after our day, when I had to come home, return.
For those of you who don't know what our day is, it's the last day of school for us, the poor kids, where we get to take jollof to school.
So on our day, I returned home without my sisters, and my parents were angry. Why did you leave them, and so on? So at that point, I felt a sense of responsibility. So that was the first time I got to realize that, okay, I'm the grown-up here, and I'm supposed to make sure that they come back home. But I've never felt the pressure of being a firstborn until I completed the university, because it was then that I realized that, oops, I'm supposed to get out of my parents' house. And looking back, I realized I probably should have done that earlier, but because of the environment I was in and not being able to get any proper guidance as to how I was going to be, it didn't really happen for me that way. But now I definitely feel the pressure of being the firstborn.
We spoke about pivotal moments in your junior high, and I get where you are coming from in terms of the motivation from your pre-tech teacher. His intention was right, but then maybe probably not probably his methodology was wrong. I've also personally experienced that, but then I see that also as a pivotal moment for you to be introspective, because I had that same problem where I was always the best English student in wherever I find myself. I was also the best English student until my final year, where I tied with a girl,
mm-hmm.
and they were like, "Oh, then let's just give it to her." Then let's just give it to her, and it pissed me off.
Mm-hmm.
It pissed me off. But then, after some like careful considering, I was like, "Oh, well, it's we guys are always like getting stuff. So, yeah. I mean, if you give it to her, it will just let other girls like know that okay, you know what." Yeah, this is something that we can also do, because you know the pressure on boys in the educational system is extremely high. It's higher than for the girls, and we don't realize that that there's a lot of undue pressure on us, and especially if there are girls who are as good or better,
mm-hmm.
there's unnecessary pressure on you to perform. Your masculinity is called into question, and like it's all tied together to make you feel like if you don't do this, then you're a girl. And at that stage, they are basically telling us that being a girl is a bad thing. What encouraged me was that in the non-traditional like courses where like was the girls who were supposed to top, I was topping that. So when she got the prize for the English, I got the prize for sewing.
Wow.
So I was like, yeah, well, if you're taking my English and I'm taking your sewing. So I guess that's how it played out for me. Oh. Yeah, but let's look at senior high. Okay. Where did you go to senior high?
The only boys' school. You know that, can you guess? National Science and Maths.
Please don't tell me it's PSEC.
Of course it is PSEC.
Jesus
of course.
Christ. Okay.
That is the only boys' school.
Move on. Let's move on before we have an unnecessary argument. Okay, so you stayed in Accra?
Yeah.
Okay, that's good. That's good. That's good. So you went to PSEC?
Yeah, PSEC Legon.
PSEC Legon. Okay. And you did which course?
Science with Geography.
Science with... Oh, okay. So an S1 boy.
Yeah. I was in D2. That's how we...
So that's how you classified it?
Yeah. D2. There was a D1 and B2.
Okay. So Science with Geography. How was your years in PSEC like?
Okay. So first year... was when I was trying to find my grounds, because senior high is like a mini university where you meet different people. There are so many clubs, there are so many things. So it was a new atmosphere for me, and it's highly a religious school. So in first year, I was trying to find my bearings in terms of the religiosity over there. And I think right at the end of first year was when I became born again.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I realized that the competition was tougher than when I was in primary, because there were people who were brilliant, and it's a meeting of brilliant people from other schools, like the top people. So I was always trying to find a way to always improve. But I would say that my whole personality probably started from PSEC, and that was because I began to understand a couple of emotional characteristics about me. Because in first year I got depressed somehow, and that was due to my spiritual side, if I should put it that way. Because I remember the very first question I asked when I got to PSEC among the religious guys was that, what is faith? I asked one of the leaders, what is faith? Because I was too, the way they were always going around preaching, I always felt probably I'm missing out on something, because like they have something that I don't. So I kept asking, and he gave me some definition. And though I didn't understand, I felt like, well, it sounds good. So I just took it on, and I started developing from there. I started reading a whole lot of religious books and all that. And I love reading, so I began to see some concepts here and there, and it sounded very, very good. So I picked up on it. But I noticed along the way that I wasn't somehow satisfied. So I became depressed at certain points because sometimes I'll pray, and whilst I'm praying, I'll stop. I don't know what caused me to stop. So I started asking myself certain questions in my head because I couldn't see the full picture. And I really, really got depressed to the point that I could stay up till 12 a.m. I got insomnia from that. I became a worrywart. I was always anxious about the next thing, always giving scenarios about results that would happen or wouldn't happen, and so on. So in my second year, I totally went off and I became a backslider again, and I felt quite guilty because this is not supposed to happen to me. In fact, when I was spiritual during that time, I was the type of person that people would look at me and go like, okay, because of you, I'll come for SU, I'll come for Scripture Union, or because of you, I've become a Christian, because I love to speak. I'm passionate about things that I touch. And when I became born again, I felt this whole euphoria, this love within me. I felt I could give to the whole world. So it was a new environment for me. And my parents actually loved it. When I came home, they were surprised. My sister once even said that, I'm surprised you have changed. I just can't believe it. Because it added something to my attitude and how I dealt with people. Because as I said, I was very careful, so I didn't really care about so many things. Though I had a heart of gold, definitely, but I don't really bother about so many things. So it was in Presec that I developed my spirituality to the level that became the foundation for most of my life from that time ongoing. So that's basically what happened. And I started reading a lot in Presec. So I remember once I read a book, and the introduction of the book, the author said she was on a project to read, I think, 100 books or so in a year. And I said I was going to read 1,000 books. So I actually started, any book I get, I lay hands on any book I get. And I ended up reading 365, amazingly, for that year out of the 1,000. And I felt like I could have done better. But it made me more trying to research and find out more things, because the more things I read, the more I became very enthused. And one thing that probably singled me out at that point in my history was my sexuality. Because when I started reading, I came across books like Silhouettes and Harlequin Romance. And every time I read, I felt these edges, and I was wondering, how do I
reconcile them?
Yes, because it was so strong, and I would say that I had a very high libido. I don't know if it's with everybody or that was just me. Mine was very, very, very high, and I was the kind of guy who likes to be around ladies. So it was more of a conflict for me because of my spirituality and viewing these things as not that spiritual and things that can actually push you back. So it was a mess of my emotions, what I actually want to be, the depression and everything, and not knowing exactly what was wrong with me at that point. Because I remember a friend asked me, so what is wrong with you? And I said, how can I tell you what's wrong with me when I myself don't understand what exactly is happening to me? And it was really, really terrible. Like, I could go for days without bathing. That was how terrible it was. And I felt it was some demonic something that was happening to me. But I think it was my emotional personality that was developing. Because I spoke to a friend once, and she was like, what is my emotional age? I was like, what do you mean by that? I was like, what was the first time you actually got broken? I was like, oh, okay, if that's what you refer to. Then I said that was in my senior high, when I was experiencing so many emotions that I actually cried for the first time and felt this sort of
relief.
So that was the cradle of my personality now. Then that's why I learned music. because when I got into the religious circle, one way of expressing myself, I felt I didn't have that voice as other choristers used to have. So I'll hide behind instruments like the recorder, which most people call flute, mm-hmm. and the harmonica. That's why I first learned it. And it was more of hard work on my part because I had to learn it on my own. I felt that learning this whole music stuff and all these scripts were a drudgery. So I decided I was going to do trial and error. So every time I'm with my instruments, even when I come to class, I'll be playing during break time. When the teacher is not yet in class, I'll be playing and people will be shouting, "Why are you disturbing? You're not making any music." But when I kept practicing, I got the grasp of it and I became good at music. So it was one way I used to express myself. So anytime I got depressed, I picked my instruments and play, and I felt this sort of peace because the recorder is one solo instrument that it has a soothing sound.
Yeah.
And I also had the chance to go into basketball. I love basketball because at that time I had moved to Spintex and most people in that area were basketball freaks, always going to the court and all that. But growing up in La Paz, where I played games like Pilulu and Alikuto, I was like, this game, let me try it. And it was fun because there was some touch to it, some intelligence to the game that I love. So I put myself on the floor and I developed myself to the point that I got into the school team, but only my final year. So I started the journey way from Form 1, but the people were so good that I had to keep learning one skill after the other, and I had to keep pushing till most of my seniors left and it was left with my batch that was about to complete. So I joined the school team and I became the MVP even during one inter-house.
Wow.
But the journey was quite tough because I remember once a neighbor asked his son that, "Why is that guy always training every day?" Because morning I go for jogging in the estate and usually there's this training that basketball players do where they touch the line as the marker. So they start from the center, tag the next base, come back to the center. So I kept doing that, and just imagine if you have an estate where you have probably a 3-bedroom house stretch and there are about, let's say, 11 houses on each of the sides of the road, and you use each house as a marker.
Wow.
And I kept doing that. So I developed a lot of stamina, and that's one thing that I realized, that I have a lot of stamina when it comes to athletics. So Presec was basically where my whole personality started from. But I was still spiritual to the end in a way, because I felt I had no other outlet that I could move to. But I usually use the music and the basketball to just keep me from that. So that was basically Presec.
In a way, you could say that you were suffering from being a teenager.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because that's when most of us discover our sexuality, our voice, and our personality. And in a lot of the youth, there's a lot of conflict that comes with all these discoveries, because some of that discovery involves an erosion of all your formative years. Some of that discovery involves questioning a lot of authority. And I always find that our senior high schools are not equipped to handle teenagers, because your teenage years are your rebellious years, are the years that you start to either be a part of society or go against society. It's just after your formative years when you start to question structure. And I find that our senior high schools just do not have, to them it's easier to instill structure through force than to allow questioning and growth and to allow individuality. And there's always that conflict, and with a lot of people that I talk to, what is interesting is that it's during that time that most of them either discover themselves, discover their true selves, or it's the beginning point of that particular discovery. Right, we'll take a short break, and when we come back, we'll look at life in the university, and then life now, and life after university, and all your life's philosophies. Alright, we'll be back after this.
This is the Hacktivist Podcast.
Welcome back to the Hacktivist Podcast.
And we are back. So I'm here with Peter. As usual, my name is Michael. And we have been talking about Peter's life. And we just got past your life as a pre-second. And what happened after that? You went straight to uni?
Yes. Because I wanted to be a pilot, my dad suggested. I actually wanted to go to flight school right after SHS, but my dad said it's good for me to get a degree. But for my research, I realized there was no need to get a degree for me to be a pilot. Just go for flight school and you are good to go. So I gave it a try. I went to tech to do aerospace engineering, and I loved it because it was also a whole experience on its own. And that was the time where I got involved, because I was religious at that point and wanting to know more about the things that were happening and reading a lot of books. I realized that most of the books I read always make reference to the origins of the scriptures, which had to do with the Hebrew and the Greek stuff. So I delved a lot into biblical hermeneutics, learning about the scriptures here and there. I even started creating this devotional guides that we spread on WhatsApp. I used to do that a lot, and I receive a lot of feedback. Oh, thank you, I didn't understand what this meant. And because I understood the historicity of everything, it was easy for me to break things down. And I really got so much into the Hebrew that I could speak it at a certain point. So the more I began to study the scriptures, I realized that the Hebrew scriptures in particular, I realized it was totally different. The interpretation was totally different from the mainstream Christianity. So I began to worry about the contradiction I was facing, because it started with this festival, this Christian festival, Christmas and all that, and I realized that they had no basis in scriptures, and in fact the festivals are actually supposed to celebrate, which are not celebrating them and all that. So I began to isolate myself from the mainstream sort of thinking, because I now had the foundation right in front of me, and I couldn't put the two together. So I began to speak more towards that side, which seemed pretty much academic. Mm-hmm. Because anything I saw in the scriptures, I'll try and get the Hebrew interpretation, and I realized that it's totally way off what we were taught. So I began to wonder if I was being lied to or something else. So whilst I went along that path, it got to a point and I realized that if I was mistaken about what I actually thought it meant, then even with this one that I have, could I even be mistaken about it? So I delved more into a lot of history, church history, and that was where it did it for me, because I started realizing the hypocrisy and the cover-ups and the evil nature of my own religion, and I realized that there's something wrong over here. And I actually had discussion with the pastor, because I was very vocal in my religion, and I sit pastors down and I say, oh, this is what I've seen, and this and that and that and that and that, so why are we doing it this way? And I realized they give some excuse, and I go like, no. And being wanting to stay true to my religion, I felt that I'll be lying, or I'll be a hypocrite if I actually don't go according to the correct one. So most of my time on campus was spent at religious meetings. I was in Nubji, that was for the Presbyterians, and I loved attending programs here and there. And what I usually did was, because I was also into music, anytime I feel bored, I pick my instruments, go and sit at the Royal Parade Grounds, it's a park, and I sit there and I play, or I'll go to the Great Hall because the acoustics were very good, and I'll play some soothing song. And that's where I realized that people began to appreciate my music. So anytime anybody saw me, hey, the guy who plays Enshima, I really like it, and so it touched me and all that. And I got to the next level of adding another instrument, that's the accordion. Because ever since I was young, I love listening to those songs because they made a lot of sense to me and they sort of preached morality as I expected it to be. So I developed this burning desire to sing like that. In fact, anytime I sang, my sisters would tell me, ah, why are you singing as if you are talking? Because most of those songs have this raspy aspect to it and all that. So when I got to university, I met a friend whose friend played the accordion, and that was why I started learning and playing the accordion. It came almost natural to me because I just loved it, and it became something that I did. And even up to now, I still have an accordion, but I hardly play because I don't have my original anymore. So it was in final year where I became vegan, and I was concerned about my health. So I started researching about a whole lot of things, and I got to realize some of these chemicals that over the long term are not good for you and all that. So I started taking out one food stuff after the other. I stopped taking processed foods. I preferred raw foods. Things like tinned tomatoes, I didn't really like it because of the preservatives and all these things that I had bread on. Then gradually, I got to the point where I realized that even taking meat wasn't necessary. And in fact, over the long term, you are likely to have more risk than if you're more plant-based. So I also cut that one out and I completely went vegan. And I remember I did one thing I've probably not done in my life before, where I was able to tell my parents that I am no longer going to do this, but this is what I want to do, because I felt so strongly about being a vegan. So I texted them that anytime they wanted to visit me or bring me anything, they shouldn't include any processed foods or any meat or anything of that sort. And my dad was like, oh, that's good, because he even wants to start going plant-based. So because I had grown up being a meat eater and now I became a vegan, I felt this sort of freedom that I was actually able to decide on something by myself, because I was convinced of whatever I had learned. And at that same point, I had this same similar conflict about my religion, because I realized that I no longer believed the mainstream teachings. And I actually went into this, I don't know if I should call it denomination, it's called Hebrew Roots Movement. I don't know if you must have heard of it, where they teach the Torah. They usually call Christianity as Churchianity because they believe Christians have distorted the Hebrew interpretation and all that. So I went online, joined some communities, Hoshana Rabbah. There were these communities online that usually teach and give the Hebrew interpretation and all that. And there was a lot of, should I say, bastardization of mainstream Christianity. So I developed this sort of bigotry subconsciously, because I felt that, okay, I know what the scriptures say and you guys are doing it wrong. So at every point in time, I felt that I have the right to actually tell them what they have to believe. But it got to a point where it became too much, and I realized that it wasn't healthy for me, one, in the first place, because I wasn't changing anything. Though people were getting some good information from the things I used to teach and show, got to a point I realized that, one, it wasn't healthy for me, and two, how am I even sure of the things I'm now talking about? Then somehow I think I chanced on a debate. I don't remember exactly when, but it started with, I think, Christopher Hitchens and Dawkins, because I started reading more about all these scientific things that usually come up when Christians are talking about the world and say, oh, they believe in this, they believe in that, and as we say, I'm not supposed. So somehow I chanced upon a debate. I don't know if it was either Christopher Hitchens or Richard Dawkins. Now, when I listened to them, I was like, wow, because they actually had some proper footing with the things that they used to say. So I began to question everything. And I remember there was this man, Bart Ehrman. He's a biblical scholar. And he actually showed how inconsistent and probably inaccurate the New Testament or the Bible basically is. So when I realized that, I was like, I can't believe this anymore, because there are copies of the copies of the copies of the copies, and there's no original thing to show, and even the existence of some of these people is quite questionable. So at that point, it had done it for me, but somewhere I still held that religiosity in me. Then it got to a point where I just had it. I realized that, no, this thing doesn't make any sense anymore. I actually don't believe all these things that I've been taught. So at that point, I was like, nah, I don't believe anymore. And it was a difficult point for me, because trying to dissociate from that and still have my worldview intact was quite difficult. So in university, despite the fact that engineering was somehow tough because of the demands and hours of studies you had to put in, and the abstract things involved, I still found some time, and in fact most of the time I spent studying the scriptures, because I began to discover one thing after the other. And at a point, I even traded one of my course marks for studying the scriptures. I could study the Bible for like 6 hours a day. I come back from lectures, I just open the Bible, the Hebrew Bible. I used to read it purely in Hebrew, because I felt that the English wasn't good enough for me. That was basically what happened in university. So in university, I was a class rep, and also that was the point I began to realize some things about myself in terms of my emotions, because at that point, most of my classmates, you can't treat them as kids. They can do whatever they want to do, and people have different sort of personalities, and my patience was gradually taking, because I was the type of guy who wanted lectures to go on and would want the lecturer to actually give us more assignments and all that, but other people were not in that way, and they are not that cooperative when I'm trying to relay some information as a class rep. So it really got to me, and at a point I just had it. I broke off, and I think I shouted at some people, and I realized I was exhibiting some too much negative energy. So at that point, I began to sit down and think about how I should relate with other people, because I realized it wasn't my thing, or so I thought. I thought it was evil to go along that tangent, because as I said, I've been a sanguine. I have the heart of gold. So why am I getting fed up at this particular point in time? So that was another aspect where I actually proved that I remember that. And I had a best friend who probably supported me in terms of my emotions, because she understood some of the things I went through. We used to chat a lot and all that, and it was also a whole love issue in there in terms of relationship, because it was always on and off here and there, and I really couldn't pinpoint exactly probably what I was looking for in terms of my love life. So it became very depressing, because I thought, why am I actually headed? Because I've not really defined anything for myself. But my friendship with my best friend helped me a lot, because it gave me the chance to actually be a good listener, because she went through some things that I don't think anybody would want to go through, and she was always crying here and there. Even her parents didn't know some of the things that were happening to her. And since I've not mentioned her name, let me just say she was raped by some of her relatives, by her teachers, not once, not twice, and all that. And seeing something like that made me think a lot about probably what emotions probably mean, because if I've not had such an experience, and someone has had, and the person is still intact, then I don't need to bullshit myself when some things happen to me. So I always listened to her, and I began to learn how to listen without speaking, because sometimes in those situations, nothing you say is going to solve the problem. You are not in the person's shoes, and you can't pretend you exactly know what's going on. But from the emotions that are showing, you can at least offer some words of help. So I think that developed some sort of kind-heartedness in me to always listen to people. So people always love me, because every time I get to talk, I'm always listening, trying to find out, oh, how are you doing here and then, all that. But there was this hole in my heart, if I can put it that way, where I felt that I'm not being listened to. I've gotten to the point where I can actually listen to anybody can approach me, but I've not really found that environment where I can say that, okay, I feel that my sexual drive is too high, and I feel that maybe some of the things I do sexually are not that good, because I didn't mention it in high school. That was when I got introduced to porn, and it was an outlet for me. So it was all a battle for me, because I didn't know how to get out of that mess, because in my head it was something evil and all that. So in university, I would say that because I kept researching and I had the ability to listen and offer kind words to most of my friends, it got to a point where I realized that I have to be kind to myself and do the best thing and just accept that I no longer believe the things I used to believe, and that the system didn't really permit me to give what I know or think, because I realized my parents tried to suppress me at certain points. When they realized I started reading this many books, they saw me reading Hebrew Bible, they were like, be careful, you are going on a path. And I was like, no, I just want to understand myself. I want to understand why all this. So if that is the reason they are giving me, that I might go astray, then it means that they are probably covering something up, because if you yourself have not read it, how then do you suggest that it will make you go on this particular tangent? And most of my friends now who know that I'm 8 years ago, like, oh, that's why I knew you'd be that way. The way you used to answer questions during Bible class, you knew so much about the Bible, and you were very high-spirited when it comes on certain issues, like you were very firm. I'm not surprised you think like a scientist and all that. So it was a gradual process, but it was in final year that I finally decided that, well, I just have to leave all these things behind, because it was very, very hard. It was very, very tough, and it actually added a second phase of depression to me at that point, because first, I hadn't resolved what had happened earlier in senior high, and now going through all this too at the same time was very, very, very terrible. So university was I'm surprised I came out alive, because it was very probably worse than secondary school, but at the same time, because I was trying to get my vision and my personality in place, it didn't really escalate that much. So that was university.
I mean, the way to mold iron is to cast it in fire. So in effect, all these situations that we go to help to shape our worldview, all the negatives and positives are what define us as people. With respect to finally identifying as atheists, right? The trauma of that is mostly because of the sunken cost that we've put into it. So you can imagine yourself and all that you've put into believing in a deity, and then coming to a point where you'd have to reconcile with giving up, like, what you've lost basically is your time, your energy. So it's mostly very difficult for people to finally let go and say, you know what, this is bullshit. And it's also difficult because, and this is why you go through a transition where, for instance, with you, you'd say, oh, I'm now going to read a Hebrew. Or then, oh, now I'm now going to maybe be a Jew.
Yeah.
Or then, oh no, now I'm now going to be a deist. So you always see people going through the phases, and then they work through it, and then finally, most people just end up at being just atheist, just not believing. So it's not atypical, it's actually a typical pathway. Now, the irony of what you were saying about your friends saying, oh, we knew we were going to be atheists, is that what they're basically saying is that knowledge breeds atheism. Mm-hmm. What your parents were telling you is that if you know, you will not believe. Mm-hmm. And I've seen this on church billboards, like demonizing knowledge. Central to the entirety of the Old Testament is the glorification of wisdom, the glorification of knowledge. And yet, it is the same wisdom, it is the same knowledge that leads one towards the path of atheism. So it is, there's this inherent contradiction in belief in itself, where the fear is, if you know too much, you will stop believing. But then we want you to know just enough to believe and to get more people to believe. But then we don't want you to know too much, because once you know too much, you start seeing the holes in the plot.
Yeah.
And it becomes problematic.
And to add to that, one conflict I faced was that, so I'm going to actually lose my community, because what would be the essence of going to sit and listen to a sermon that I no longer view as true, or the foundation is weak? And because of that, even up to now, I still go to church for two reasons. To avoid confrontation from my parents, because they are highly fundamentalist, very devout, and sometimes when I listen to them having a conversation on maybe some church issues, and I see how hard they are on certain things, I feel it's not the best for me at this point to let them know about my current situation. Though some of my friends do know, some of my friends who I think will be able to listen and hear me out, they know, but my parents don't know that I'm an atheist, though they can sense that there's something wrong somewhere. And at the same time, I also go to church for the community I've already established, because that's what I knew my whole life, and I've built very good friendships from that even up to today. So sometimes it's either two things: either I'm going to please my parents and avoid confrontation because they are old now, after I'll get out of the house anytime soon, and secondly, to sort of, in quotes, discuss logic with some of my friends, because I know the harm it can do, and the sort of bigotry and things it can lead on to. So sometimes I go there and engage them in, I think you already know that they're street epistemology. Yeah. I do that a lot. For most of my colleagues, I've had those kind of conversations with them, so that they can also start thinking for themselves. So that's the situation now. So sometimes at home, when I'm making a call, and the call is maybe a conversation on any of the topics of humanism or let's say religion, I get out of the house because I don't want my parents to hear and get into this whole thing. I think I've not yet found a way to be comfortable with that yet. So that's another issue too.
Okay, we'll take another break. When we come back, we'll talk about your dalliance with street epistemology. We'll talk about humanism and some of the other labels and philosophies that you subscribe to. We'll be right back.
This is the Hacktivist Podcast.
Welcome back to the Hacktivist Podcast.
Welcome back to the Hacktivist Podcast. I'm still here with Peter. My name is still Michael. We had looked at your life in university and to the burden stages of your questioning and trying to find who you are and coming to terms with your various identities. You've talked about your atheism. And what happened afterwards?
So I was basically my closet with my thoughts, because I know it's a no-go area for my immediate environment. It's something that is frowned upon and seen as evil. And being a Christian once, I definitely knew the repercussions of what this meant. So I usually listened a lot to debates because that was my only comfort in hearing other people voice out the same things I had discovered. So usually I listen to the Atheist Experience, that is the atheist community of Austin.
So by Atheist Experience, you're talking of the Matt Delahunty show on YouTube?
Yes. Okay. I found it quite interesting the kind of questions he's able to ask and being able to put logic in a simple form, which I wasn't exposed to. And because the issue of faith is all about unreason. It's been said that to have faith, you need to close the eye of reason. So seeing someone being able to voice out logic so comfortably, it interested me a lot. So I began to learn more about logic, logical fallacies here and there. And I was so surprised the amount of knowledge in there. And I also noticed that most of the confrontations in daily life, sometimes it gets into an argument. But from the Delahunty show, I realized that it was people who were ready to call and have a conversation. So despite the fact that it had that antagonistic sort of tone to it, they still had a conversation anyway. But if you try it in real life, you're really not going to get any results. So one of their hosts, I think Anthony Magnabasco, he usually mentions something about street epistemology and how it's a good way to converse with people on any topic at all without getting antagonistic. So I started looking at that, and since I'm more of the kind-hearted type who wouldn't want to throw my opinions down somehow, I was also ready to listen. So I found street epistemology as a very nice way of communicating, especially, and the irony here is that it looks like proselytizing, because you are letting the person use logic, and the indirect result of that is either the person is either going to discard the illogical beliefs, which will make the person end up either as agnostic or atheist. So many people accuse street epistemologists as being proselytizing because they are trying to convert, but this can be done on any topic at all. So it's not necessarily true that that is the goal.
Can you break it down? Because I don't think a lot of people, this may be the first time some people are hearing about street epistemology. Can you just break it down in simple terms?
Okay.
What the whole idea is?
I'm sure the word street is familiar, but epistemology might be the problem. So epistemology is basically the scope of knowledge. Everything that has to do with knowledge, the path, the content, everything in there. So street epistemology simply means that you engage in a conversation with a stranger, preferably. That's why the word street is there. You can meet anyone on the street and engage the person on a topic or belief the person holds as true, and try and find out with the person how the person arrived at that point. So it is more of the process rather than the claim being made. So if a claim is made, it is not so much about debating whether it is true or false. It is more about finding out how the person arrived there, and was that path reliable? Because in logic, you have to do with the validity and the soundness. They are two separate issues. So an argument might be valid, but it might not be sound.
Okay.
So it's the same thing with the street epistemology. Someone may make a claim, then you begin to peel off the layers and find out why the person believes that to be true. Sometimes it may be that the person was raised up that way, or the person has a particular emotional attachment to that, and because of that feels that it is true. But till you engage the person with the Socratic dialogue, where you ask questions that are appropriate to understand why the person holds that, it's difficult to get past that, because in usual conversation it's either I'm right and you are wrong and here are the facts, either you have to accept it or don't accept it. But if you are able to work with the person, and the person tries to understand where it started from and is able to judge for himself to his satisfaction whether the method he used was right or not, you can make progress from there. So street epistemology, it can be done on any topic from health to science to religion to weird beliefs, aliens, so on, abortion, and so many topics. And it's a more productive way of getting to understand why people believe the things they do. Because the benefit I see with street epistemology is that we always have a bias to think that so far as a person holds this belief, then he must have believed it because of this reason. But many people have different reasons why they believe. And also I realized that with most people who participate in street epistemology, like Daniel Reed, he has a Cordial Curiosity channel on YouTube. Antonio Magnobosco has his name as that particular channel. Then there's also one doctor, he's a black American. His channel is, Dr. Tyrone. His channel is called Let's Chat. Mm-hmm. So usually they have these setups where they invite people or people passing by just find you curious, they sit down and have a chat. And I realized that to be able to practice that first, you need to put all your biases aside and be ready to listen, in quotes, to all the bullshit without getting on that defensive or militant type of argument that we usually see. So I want to be more of a good listener. So I find street epistemology as a holistic approach to be a better listener, so that I can actually delve deeper and get to know why people believe the things they used to believe. So that's street epistemology.
Can we examine some of your other labels? What are your views on humanism?
To that question, I would say I remember when I first became an atheist and I invited one of my friends to the humanist meeting. I think I made a comment on a particular topic and he said that, how is it that you are able to think like this, because you are actually supposed to learn how to think like a humanist? So when he said that, I was surprised, because I thought, so far as I don't hold the label of the religious guy, then automatically humanism becomes clearer to me. And this is where the conversations actually need to be had. So on the issue of humanism, I would say that understanding the basic definition as putting the interest of humans first, that's how basically I see it. So in every respect, it is the human welfare we are looking at rather than any other thing. So being a humanist, to me, I understand it as putting the interest of humans first, but in doing that, using the proper tools to arrive at that point.
Yeah.
Because you can do the right things for the wrong reasons, or even the wrong things for the right reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So applying skepticism, applying critical thinking, which goes with skepticism in some cases, to be able to find out the best solution to problems. And in fact, I've had one lady accuse me of being very rational. She was saying that it would be difficult for me to date you because you try and rationalize everything. You're always trying to break things down and see how things are composed or made of. So being a humanist to me is seeing the welfare of everybody regardless of whatever label the person holds, and not being biased in my approach. So I subscribe to critical thinking, and I've actually read some courses on logic to be familiar with that aspect.
Well, are there any other labels? So right now we know atheism, agnosticism,
yes,
humanism,
skepticism.
So are there any others that
I would say that probably, of course, being a free thinker, because that's why I apply the logic and the rest. And at the same time, I think I'm finding a little bit subscription to liberalism, in the sense that the things that I used to believe were true, that I no longer find to be true. I no longer have any reason to be opposed to it because I don't have the facts to go
around. Can you give us some examples?
So the LGBT community, for instance, I actually have this sort of penchant in protecting their orientation because I believe that to be as part of humanism, being the welfare of, looking after the welfare of your fellow human, regardless of whatever label the person has. So I would say I'm not so much of an activist, but I'm an ally. It would be the same thing with feminism. I would say I've not fully grasped the concept because there are so many other packages that go around, but the basic or the foundation for what feminism stands for, I do support it in a lot of ways, like not being biased because of the gender of someone. So I say I'll be an ally of the LGBT community and also of feminism. And I would say another label I would have is, people accuse me of being a scientist. I don't know what that means.
Why do people keep accusing you of things which are good? Like, what next? People are going to accuse you of being a philanthropist. People are accuse you of being wealthy. Like, what's happening?
I think it's the society we live in that has painted it that way. I think the other time I mentioned that my dad actually said, he's not going to have any intellectual discussion with me. And that's because I'm too hard when it comes on peeling down stuff. Even in normal conversation, I go along that street epistemology route where I'm always asking question after question after question after question. But I realize it helps one. The person realize probably the predicament he or she may be in. And it also gives me the opportunity to learn more from that. So many people accuse me of being too, in quote, intelligent or rational when it comes to certain things. I believe we are taught what to think instead of how to think. And the how to think is believing as many true things as possible and as few false things as possible. But in reaching that, you need to first start from the premise that you could be wrong. And from that, you could learn from it. So there's this issue of confirmation bias, which usually happens when, if you believe something, it's easy for you to research on things that supports what you already believe, rather than starting from the opposite end and trying to see things that disagree with your position. Only then will you be able to make an informed decision, because there are two extremes, and looking at the facts, you could see some more clues here and there. So I think that logic actually should be taught as a course, because when that is done, then it would help expedite the teaching process, because it will help people ask more questions that are relevant to whatever field that they are in. And also the issue of bigotry, let me give this example. So I was very homophobic towards the LGBT community because of what I was taught. Now, the only way out of that was trying to place myself in their shoes and try and understand where they are coming from. And the moment I did that, I realized that, okay, I have no reason not to like them or treat them as humans. So being able to put yourself in the shoes of another person would help you understand the process with which they get to something. It's not necessarily only about experience, but even common everyday interactions,
which is basically empathy.
Exactly.
Yeah, and empathy can be taught.
It can be taught, but this is where I think it actually starts from how to think, because when you are on that process or on that journey of trying to understand and thereby asking the right questions, it becomes easier for you to see the similarities that you share as a human being with other people, especially when it concerns issues that have to deal with welfare and other things, because there was this, when I did my service, there was one supervisor who I disagreed with on a particular topic, and he's a very decent man, very responsible. And whilst we were talking, he looked at me and said, if you were my son, I would have slapped you. It was concerning a religious issue. So here's a very clear case where someone is willing to use whatever, what he thinks is the case to determine how he should legislate something, rather than looking at probably what I just said and review it and see how it lines up with whatever he believes. But he's willing to go to the next step of saying that I can harm you just because you thought this way or you did it this way. So that empathy will come from our ability to first realize that we could be wrong and that we don't know so many things and that we are also biased. So even though I may be someone who has a love for logic and critical thinking, I may be biased at certain points. It will only depend on someone to say, you know what, you just use this particular fallacy over here, and I should be willing to accept it. Because if I don't accept it at that point, then basically the whole aim of me learning the logic is flawed. And sometimes it can be difficult. We all act as idiots sometimes, but it takes someone to point it out. So it's the how to think. So if you are ready to accept correction, then it's easier for you to go on to the next stage in how to think. So I believe logic should be taught as a course, because it's only then that people will be on the same page whilst having a fruitful discussion.
Our educational system doesn't lend to students actually questioning authority. But one of the first things you learn in critical thinking and in logic class is to question authority, is that there is no authority.
Mm-hmm.
Like, authority can be overturned at any point in time. Now, that is what most teachers fear, because their authority is all they have. So unless there is a cultural shift towards accepting the frailty of hierarchies, accepting that all our beliefs, including the ones that we hold extremely dear, could be overturned at any point in time.
Well, I think probably we belittle the fact that the formative years of kids are very important, and whatever sticks with them at that point may probably be very difficult to change over the years. And we don't give them the credit enough that probably, and this is just a speculation, but from what I've seen teaching kids and all that, they are intelligent than adults when it comes to being able to figure out the questions to ask. They can ask you a question and you just be completely stupefied, because you probably never thought of that question, but you realize the impact of that question. And once that sort of thing is shut down during the
formative
years, now the person is closed off to any sort of reason or any sort of progress from that point in time, because the person feels that it is not good for me to be asking such questions. But it is some of these questions that actually would help create a better society. I remember when I was teaching one kid, and after that I did a magic trick to her. And when the dad came back to the house, this is what he told the dad. Dad, come and see, this guy has magic powers. So when the dad left, I asked her that, if I teach you how to do this trick, does it mean you have powers? And she looked at me and said that, no. And I said, do you then believe in magic? And it's like, no. It was as something simple as that in engaging.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't tell her what to think, but I asked the questions, and based on what she had also seen, she had realized that, okay, I might be wrong over here.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point is where you actually need to engage the most. And most people find it threatening, especially people who are already biased in certain ways. And it might not be their fault, because it was also done to them, probably by someone. So they feel that I also need to pass or instill this sort of harshness to my children, because if they go this way, they are likely to end up this way. But that's a slippery slope because you can't demonstrate that that is exactly what's going to be the case. But at the same time, I believe that it should start from somewhere. And you can start it from your house. You can start it because it being a cultural thing, everybody is separated by almost 5 degrees of freedom. I know someone who knows someone who knows someone. So by tracing that, if we are able to pass some information through that cycle, with time, I believe that the playing field will be level enough for everybody to know that, okay, when it comes to this issue, you can think about it this way as well. Then you can have conversations from there. So whatever sort of field you find yourself, especially for teachers, it'll be quite disheartening on your part to find that probably your kid is being told what to think from a different, let's say, teacher. So let's create this scenario where you are a Christian teacher and you are teaching, you believe that, okay, these are the values and everything that should be had. Now think about this, if your child is also in a different environment and is being taught by, let's say, a Buddhist or a Muslim, and that Buddhist or Muslim goes along that same tangent and begins to say that this is how, I'm sure probably you'd be enraged that that shouldn't be part of what you teach. So if it means that, then you should question what you are also doing at that particular point and see how objective it is. If you've concluded that it's objective, then there should be some sort of consensus around. But so far as that the classroom is meant for teaching and learning, it's not only about the teaching, it's also about the learning. So it's in the learning that you have to understand that there are different competing ideas, and the best ideas have to win based on the foundations of logic. So if you do not have that in the first place, it's difficult for you now to see exactly what is logical. And it's quite a painful process because you get to the point where you realize that I can't really be certain, 100% certain about anything, because things can change. And when it changes, it means I have to admit that I was wrong about this particular issue. So I think logic can be taught. It has to first start from your home. It has to start from your conversations here and there. Then with that, I think society would catch up to it. Because at this point in time where people's lives can be in danger just because of what they think, not even what they do, but just the fact that they have certain thoughts, is we can basically kill ourselves to extinction if we are going to think that way. But as intelligent beings as we suppose we are, the best thing to do is to have a discussion, not a teaching service where it's all about what I know and take it or leave it. So that's what I think.
Thank you very much, Peter. This has been a very interesting conversation. This is what I want to say, and then we can end this podcast, right? This is all we've been talking about is about power, and it's about letting go. It's about sharing that power. So in the home, you would find parents wanting to retain as much power over the children as possible. In the school, you find teachers trying to retain as much power over students as possible. And then in government, you find people in government wanting to retain as much power as possible from the populace. And none of this helps conversations. None of this helps growth. None of this helps progress. So if you want to start from the homes, then parents should be able to have a relationship with their kids where they can admit to the kids that they don't know. They can be more honest with the children. They can be able to have conversations with the children as not just as kids, but as also young adults, as the next generation. As long as we are open to having conversations, as long as we are open to admitting that we are wrong, admitting that there are gaps in our knowledge, and then making efforts to close those gaps, I'm sure we'll be all right. Awesome. And on this note, we'd like to thank you for listening. This has been the Hacktivist Podcast.
This has been the Hacktivist Podcast.
As always, think for yourself and care for others.